can understand that the Christians use this to frighten the fairies away.
Thank you.
Can we go on the bells?
Yes, just a little bit quieter.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're not meant to talk about the mapping audio, Nathan.
Yes, yes, he is. Yes, he is.
I think it's that.
Full
it's David.
It's just.
Oh, it's a camera.
It's Mr. Spangler. That's who it is.
You want to get more?
Oh, dear.
What we're doing, in a certain sense, when we look at the Mabinogi, we look at the at the moment we're just looking at the four branches. There's lots of other stories we're going to look at, but we come back to the four branches of the Mabinogi. We're looking into the mind and heart of a particular writer at a particular time. You know, it's a great work of art, the four branches. So that the and one of the things, as we noticed yesterday, was the way in which so we're being told certain important things, and we're being shown that descent into the underworld, we're shown the quality of Poich and his good qualities and his more difficult qualities. And right at the beginning, in that encounter with Arawn, where he makes a mistake, which then leads, of course, to other things happening. But within that story, there is another thing that could have happened, which Prune spotted, where if he had not driven off the pack, if he had allowed Arawn as the huntsman and the ghostly hounds to claim the prize that is the heart, the dying heart, dying stag, he would have been witness to the mystery of the death and the resurrection of the dying god who is the servant of the goddess. So he would have more directly entered into the mystery. He would have entered into the experience of Pen Anavan much more directly and fully than he ever does later on. And you see later on in the writings around the Grail tradition that the white stag takes you to the Grail castle, takes you into the mysteries of the Grail, which are the mysteries of death and resurrection. Now you see that conveyed in a single image. But the great creative ability of the writer of the Four Branches is that she shows us, reflects back at us, the ways in which we get it wrong. And it's reflected in others of the Grail stories later on, but that sense of wanting it for yourself. He wants the stag for himself. So he drives off the hounds of the other world. So the mystery is not enacted. He does not get to experience the mystery. He's given another chance. He changes shape with Arawn. He does that really well and then makes another error. He nearly makes an error with Havgan. Rhiannon appears. He gets it wrong at first with Rhiannon because he doesn't talk to her. He doesn't enter into a relationship. He tries to chase her down. He gets it finally. He gets the fact he has to talk to her. She stops. They agree to marry, but he doesn't listen to her. He rushes in at the wedding feast, and he potentially loses Rhiannon and everything else, and she has to put everything right. Now that continued iteration is because what the writer is doing is showing us the ways in which we can continually lose it. But she's also showing us the fact that no loss is final, because something else happens that brings him back onto the track again and again. Now, where we ended, where we ended last time, is that the Pryderi is found because of Tyrion and his wife, and right at the end, he blows it again. He doesn't let Rhiannon name her own child. He listens to the men around him, in particular the druid, and gives him this peculiar name, Pryderi, which means anxiety, worry. What a worry the boy is. Now, we would expect now, really, to learn what happens next to Pryderi, or what happens next to Pwyllgwr Pryderi. So that's sort of like tenterhooks, you know, that's the kind of, right, that's one thing that's... But the second branch... Well, Pryderi does get mentioned in the second branch, but as the most minor of characters. Because where we come in the second branch of the Mabinogi is the stories of the children of Clear. And in particular, double L-Y-R, Clear.
Double L.
Double L-Y-R.
Double L.
The children of Clear here are Bendigeidvran. Bran the Blessed. Mm-hmm. His sister Branwen. Bran, whose name means raven. Mm-hmm. Branwen, whose name is Holy Raven or White Raven, the sister. Nissen and Evernissen. Nissen's N-I-S-S-Y-N. Evernissen is Evie in front of Nissen. The twins. N-Y-S-S-E-N, Nissen. And Evanescent is E-V-N-Y-S-S-E-N. Spelling varies in different texts because spelling was not standard in those days. Yes, actually, in fact, Fiona Davis actually spells Nissen N-Y-S-I-E-N. So Bendigeidvran, which means name means blessed raven, so I'll spell it. B-E-N-D-I-G-E-I-D Bendig. B-E-N-D-I-G Bendig Idvran. E-I-D-F-R-A-N. Bendig means blessing, and Bran is a normal name for raven. But if you combine it with the suffix of blessed, by mutation, it becomes Idivran. Bendigeidvran, son of Clir, was crowned king over this island, and invested with the crown of London. One afternoon he was in Havelech in Abdudwy, at one of his courts, sitting on the rock of Havelech above the sea, with his brother Manawydan, son of Clir, his two brothers on his mother's side, Nissen and Evernissen. His two brothers on his mother's side were the sons of Erisedd by his own mother Penavadin, daughter of Beli, son of Manogan. One of these was a good lad. He could make peace between two armies when they are most enraged. That was Nissen. The other would cause two of the most loving brothers to fight. As they're sitting there, they can see 13 ships coming from the south of Ireland, heading towards them easily and swiftly, the wind behind them, and they were approaching with speed. So we're given this image of him sitting on a great rock, looking out to the west, watching ships coming with his brothers. Now we've got the good brother, Nissen and Evernissen, who are clearly representing opposites. And we have Manawydan, who is a different kind of man from the men we have previously seen, who appears most strongly in the third branch of the Mabinogi. And he is the man who listens to women, who is at one with the goddess. He also has a connection to the Chiron of Clear are connected to water, to, in a certain sense, you could say the family of Poich are down in the depths, they're down in the earth. Chiron of Clear, Clear is one of the great Welsh sea figures. So there is a relationship between this family and the sea and the west, looking out towards the sea. In the direction of the first branch, we're looking down into the south, and down into the depths of the land, and into the mysteries of the dying stag and the otherworldly lord, and the union between the other world and the human world. Now here we're looking west into the sea and what comes out of the sea. And the figure who is the kingly figure here is the blessed raven. And his sister is the holy raven, Branwen. So in these few lines, in just even in these names, we are given a sense of both direction, the west, water, the sea. Manawatan is connected with the sea. It's very similar to MacNannan MacLear in the Irish texts, the sea god. And we've got these opposites of Nissen and Evanissen, and we have these totemic raven figures as central figures. So we're with the opposites of life and death, in particular death, because the raven is the death bird. We're also with the mysteries of sovereignty. That's why the ravens are still kept in the tower. And are connected in the Welsh stories. The head of Bran was once buried at the end of the story is buried underneath the tower until Arthur comes and digs it up. The peculiarity of Bran is that Bran is a giant, a vast figure. So he's not seen in a kingly hall, he is seen sitting on a great rock looking out to sea. And in a nutshell, the story of the second branch has Matholwch, King of Ireland, comes to Bran and proposes a deal, whereby the he marries Branwen, and is given a great bride price for and it will be forever where there will be peace between the Kingdom of Ireland and the people of the Island of the Mighty, Britain. Branwen typically has no say in this. And there is a great marriage feast. But because of Evanissen's ability to cause trouble, he is sent away. Not involved in any of the decision making, not involved in anything to do with the feast. And what happens is when he returns and discovers his sister has been given to Matholwch without his knowledge, without his permission, without his understanding, he does a terrible thing, which I'll read, because it's horrible to read, but it is still an important bit of the story. He comes across the lodgings of Matholwch's horses and asks whose horses they were. These are the horses of Matholwch, King of Ireland, they said. What are they doing here, he said. The King of Ireland is here and has slept with Branwen, your sister, and these are his horses. Is that what they have done with such a fine maiden and my sister, that, given away without my permission, they could not have insulted me more? And he went for the horses and cut their lips to the teeth and their ears down to their heads and their tails to their back, and where he could get a grip on the eyelids, he cut them to the bone, and that way he maimed the horses. They were no good for anything. The news reached Matholwch. He was told how his horses had been maimed and spoiled, so they were no good for anything. "Well, Lord," said one, "you've been insulted, and it was done deliberately." "God knows, I find it strange if they wanted to insult me, that they should first of all have given me such a fine maiden of such high rank, so beloved by their family." "Lord," said another, "it's perfectly clear, there's nothing for you to do but to return to your ships." So Matholwch made for his ships. The news reached Bendigeidfran that Matholwch was leaving the court, without asking, without permission. Messengers went to ask him why he was going. Messengers who went were Ithig, son of Anarog, and Hivaithir. These men caught up with him and asked him what was his intention and why he was leaving. "God knows," he said, "if I had known, I would not have come here. I've been completely insulted. No one has ever been on such a worse expedition than this one. And a strange thing has happened to me. I was given Bronwyn, daughter of Clear, one of the three chief maidens of this island, and daughter to a king of the Island of the Mighty, and I slept with her. But after that, I was insulted. And I find it strange that the insult was not done before such an excellent maiden as that was given to me." "God knows, Lord, the insult was not done to you with the approval of the one who rules the court, nor any one of his council. Though you consider this a disgrace, this insult and deception is worse for Bendigeidfran than it is for you." "Yes," he said, "perhaps so, but yet Bendigeidfran cannot undo the insult just because of that." The man returned with an answer to Bendigeidfran and told him what Matholwch had said. "Well," Bendigeidfran said, "it is no good if he goes away angry, and we cannot allow it. Tell him he shall have a sound horse for every one that was maimed, and as his honour price a rod of silver as thick as his little finger, as tall as himself, and a plate of gold as broad as his face. And tell him what sort of man did this, and how it was done against my will, and that a brother on my mother's side did it, and it is not easy for me either to kill him or destroy him. Let him come and see me, and I will make peace on whatever terms." And they talk, and it's not going well. And he says, "I will increase your compensation too. I will give you a cauldron, and the property of the cauldron is that if you throw into it one of your men who was killed today, then tomorrow he will be as good as ever, except he will not be able to speak." Matholwch thanked him for that and was extremely happy on account of the cauldron. And there's a whole story about how the cauldron comes from the other worlds. And then they go back, so all appears well. They go back to Ireland. And first of all, Branwen has great kind of great honour, and she's given lots of renown and treasures. She becomes pregnant, and she gives birth to a little boy called Gwerin. Boy is fostered, and this all goes on in the first year. But then in the second year, there is a murmuring of dissatisfaction because of the insult that Matholwch received in Wales and the disgrace. And his foster brothers and the men close to him taunted to him quite openly, and there was such an uproar in him that there was no peace for Matholwch until he avenged the insult. They took revenge by sending Branwen from her husband's chamber and forcing her to cook for the court. And they had the butcher come to her every day after you've chopped up meat and give her a box on the ear. And that's how her punishment was carried out. And this punishment goes on for 3 years. And in the course of the 3 years, she trains a starling to carry a letter to Bendigeidfran to tell Bendigeidfran what is happening to her. And he is outraged, and he raises the armies of Wales, and they invade Ireland. He himself, because he is a great giant, and as they say, the sea was not wide, and they sailed. But Bendigeidfran waded across. There are only two rivers called the Clee and the Avachan. Bendigeidfran walked, carrying all the stringed instruments on his own back, and made for Ireland's shore. Matholwch's swineherds were on the shore that day, busy with their pigs. Because of what they saw on the sea, they went to Matholwch. What have you seen? What extraordinary news. We have seen a forest on the sea where we never before saw a single tree. Could you see anything else? We could see a huge mountain between the forest, and it was moving. There was a very high ridge on the mountain, a lake on each side of the ridge, and the forest and the mountain and all of it was moving. Well, Matholoc said, there's no one here who would know anything about that unless Branwen knows something. Go and ask her. Lady, they said, what do you think it is? Though I am no lady, she said, I know what it is. The men of the Island of the Mighty coming over, having heard of my punishment and dishonour. What is the forest they saw on the sea? Masts, ships and yardarms. And what was the mountain? That was my brother, Bendigeidvran, wading across. There is no ship big enough for him. What was the high ridge and the lake on each side of the ridge? That was him looking at this island. He is angry. The two lakes on either side of the ridge are his two eyes on each side of his nose. So we're given this image of the energies of the land, of the king of the land, who somehow is the land, who is this mountainous titan, bringing the forest of the land, bringing the energies of the land towards Ireland, into the west, to retrieve the dishonoured holy raven. You know, what happens here is the making of an oath, the breaking of an oath, the remaking of an oath, the breaking of an oath. All the resonances, of course, with Trump and Zelensky and Putin, that whole territory, right? Very kind of common. So what happens then is this great sense of the invasion of Ireland to retrieve the holy maiden who has been dishonoured. So rather than being a creative interplay between the two islands, and there being a creativity and the cauldron of fertility that's been rebirth that's been given, enriching both countries, to use Frankie used to Hollywood's words, two tribes go to war. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the land of Britain, of Prydain, comes to the with it in the person of its king and in the person of its forest of people, but in the sense that's like the forest of the land, the deep places of the land of Prydain come to Ireland. And his druids tell him, right, retreat across the Liffey and put the Liffey between you and him. Destroy a bridge that crosses the river. There are lodestones on the riverbed that neither ships or vessels can sail across. Then we will be safe. And then we get this very, and so nobody, so then we'll be safe because nobody can cross this. No ships can cross this. Too big to cross. You can't swim across. And then what happens is we get this very fundamental thing, because he is this vast figure, Bendigeidvran lays his body down and becomes the living bridge between the two places. And in Welsh, there's the phrase that is used is bidbon, bidbent. Bidben, what way round? Bidben, bidbont. Who would be ahead must be the bridge. Who would be a generative source of life must be the living bridge between opposites. So what happens is the men of the Island of the Mighty pass across the bridge and terrify the hell out of Matholoc. And so Matholoc then says, okay, what can we do? And then he's given advice that let's prevent a better response for him. He's never been able to be inside a house. So what they do is they say, look, we will build you this great hall that even you can fit inside, and we will feast you for all of your troops. In this house there will be room for Bendigeidvran and the men of the Island of the Mighty are one half of the house, and in the other half of the house will be Matholoc and his troops. Place your kingship at his disposal and pay homage to him. Because of the honour in building the house, for he has never had one in which he could fit, he will make peace for you. He decides to accept that sense of peace because Branwen suggests he can, because she doesn't want the country to be laid waste. But the Irish had a cunning plan. They placed a peg on either side of each column of the 100 columns in the house, and he had a hide bag on each peg with an armed man in each one of them. Evanescence enters the house ahead of the troops of the Island of the Mighty and casts fierce, ruthless glances around the house. He caught sight of the hide bags among the pillars. "What is in this bag?" he said to one of the Irishmen. "Flour, friend," he answered. Evanescence prodded the bag until he found the man's head, and he squeezed the head until he could find his fingers sinking into the brain through the bone. He left another one, put his hand on another bag and said, "What have we here? Flour, friend." Evanescence plays the same game with each of them so that not one man was left alive of the entire 200, apart from one. And he came to that one and he said, "What have we here? Flour, friend," said the Irishman. It's also an Irish joke, this, right? Because the people who... It's such an old joke about the Irish being stupid, because the people that are speaking are the people in the bag. What have we got here? Only flour. All right.
It's the first Irish joke, is it?
Very early Irish joke. He left. So the played this game, he came to the last one. What have we here? Flower friend. Prodded the bag and he found the man's head. And just as he squeezed the head of the other, so he squeezed this one. He could feel armour in the head of this one. He did not let him go until he had killed him. Then he sang in England. "There is in this bag a different kind of flower. Champions, warriors, attackers in battle. Fighters prepared for combat." And then he goes into the background. Then peace is made, Bendigeidfran, the boy, so the Macdholach designs will resign his kingship in favour of Gwern, who is Branwen's son. So peace is made, Bendigeidfran calls the boy to him. The boy went from Bendigeidfran to Manawadan, and everyone who saw him loved him. He went to Nissan, and who loved him. And then Evanescence said, "Why doesn't my nephew, my sister's son, not come to me? Even if he were not King of Ireland, I would still like to make friends with the boy." "Let him go gladly," said Bendigeidfran. The boy went to him cheerfully. "I confess to God," said Evanescence to himself, "the outrage I shall now commit is one the household will never expect." He gets up, he takes the boy by the feet, and immediately before anyone in the house can lay a hand on him, he hurls the boy headfirst into the fire. When Branwen sees her boy, her son's burning in the fire, she tries to jump into the fire. But Bendigeidfran seizes her with one hand, seizes his shield with the other. Then everyone in the house leaps up. And this was the greatest uproar by ever a crowd in one house, as each one took up arms. And Morfudd Tylluan said, "Hounds of Gwern, beware of Morfudd Tylluan." They each went for his weapons. Bendigeidfran held Branwen between his shield and his shoulder. And then there is a great battle that happens. And eventually it starts to go badly for the people of the Island of the Mighty, because the Irish have this cauldron of rebirth. So whenever any of their people get killed, they chuck them into the cauldron, they come back again. So eventually it's like a war of attrition where they're starting to lose. Evanescence, seeing this, places himself in the cauldron, pretends to be dead, pretends to be one of the Irish dead, lays under an Irish corpse. And two barebacked Irishmen come to him and throw him in the cauldron as if he were an Irishman. He stretches out in the cauldron, so the cauldron breaks into four pieces, and his own heart breaks too. And because of this, such victory as they were went to the men of the Island of the Mighty. There was no real victory except 7 men escaped, and Bendigeidfran was wounded in the foot with a poisoned spear. The 7 men who escaped were Pryderi, so Pryderi was at this battle, Manawadan, Glyfiai, son of Taran, Taliesin, the great poet, Anog, Gwyddiai, son of Muriel, and Hylin, the son of Gwyn Hen, old Gwyn. Then Bendigeave ran, ordered his head to be cut off. "And take my head," he said, "and carried it to the Gwynfryn in London, the place where the White Tower is now, and bury it with its face towards France, and it will take you a long time to get there. You will first feast in Havelech for 7 years with the birds of Rhiannon singing to you, and you will find the head to be as good as company as ever it was when it was on me. And then you will stay for 8 years in Gwales in Benvro. And as long as you do not open the door towards Aberhenvelin, facing Cornwall, you can remain there, but the head will not decay. But as soon as you open the door, you can stay no longer. Make for London to bury the head, and now set off across the sea." So these seven men, and Branwen is the eighth, returned to Prydain, to Britain. They came ashore at Aber Alaw in Teleboleon, and they came across and rested. She looked at Ireland and the Island of the Mighty, what she could see of them, and said, "O Son of God, woe that I was ever born. Two good islands have been laid waste because of me." She brings a mighty sigh, and her heart breaks. They make a four-sided grave for her and bury her there on the banks of the Alaw. Then they journey towards Havelech carrying the head. And as they were travelling, they met a company of men and women. "Do you have any news?" said Manawydan. "No, except that Caswallan, son of Beli, has overrun the Island of the Mighty and is crowned king in London." "What happened to Caradog, son of Bran, and the seven men who were left with him on this island?" "Caswallan attacked him, and six men were killed, and Caradog's heart broke from bewilderment at seeing the sword kill his men and not knowing who killed them. Caswallan had put on a magic cloak so that no one could see him killing the men. They could see only the sword. Caswallan did not want to kill Caradog. He was his nephew, his cousin's son, and he was one of the three people who broke their hearts from sorrow. Bindaban David was a young lad with the seven men, escaped to the woods," they said. They went to Havelech and sat down and regaled with food and drink. Three birds came and began to sing them a song, and all the songs they had heard before were harsh compared to that one. They had to gaze far over the sea to catch sight of the birds, yet their song was as clear as if the birds were with them. They feasted there for 7 years. At the end of the seventh year, they sent out for Gwales in Benvro. And there was a large hall, and they went to the hall. They could see two doors open, and the third door was closed, the one facing Cornwall. "See over there," said Manawydan, "this is the door we must not open." That night they stayed there contented and lacking nothing, and all the sorrow they had seen and suffered, they remembered none of it, nor any grief in the world. And there they spent 80 years, though they were not aware of having spent even a more pleasurable or a delightful time. Having the head there was no more unpleasant than when Bendigeid had been alive to them. Because of that, those 80 years were called the Assembly of the Noble Head. The one that went to Ireland was the Assembly of Branwen and Matholwch. One day a Highland son of Gwyn said, "Shame on my beard, unless I open the door to see if they find out what they say about it is true." He'd opened the door and looked at Cornwall and at Aberhenvelin, and when he looked, every loss they had ever suffered, every companion they had lost, every ill that had befallen them, was as clear as if they'd encountered it at that very place, and most of all concerning their lord. And from that moment they could not rest, but made for London with the head. Though the road was long, they came at last to London and buried the head on the Gwynfryn. This is one of the three fortunate concealments when it was concealed, and one of the three unfortunate disclosures when it was disclosed. For no oppression would ever come across the sea to the island while the head was in the hiding place. And that is how that story goes. Their tale is the men who set out from Ireland. In Ireland, no one was left alive except for five pregnant women in a cave in the wilds of Ireland. These five women at the same time gave birth to five sons, and they reared these men until they were big lads, and their thoughts turned to women, and they each lusted after them, and each lad slept promiscuously with each other's mother, and lived in the land and ruled it and divided it between the five of them. And the five provinces of Ireland still reflect that division. And they searched the country where battles had taken place and found gold and silver until they grew wealthy. And this is how this branch of the Mabinogi ends, concerning the blow to Branwen, which is one of the three unfortunate blows in the island. And the assembly of Bran, when the army of 144 districts went to Ireland to avenge the blow to Branwen, and the feasting of Harlech for 7 years, and the singing of the birds of Rhiannon, and the assembly of the head for 80 years. So if we look at this second branch, which is profoundly different from the first branch, we will see some interesting themes. And we have to remember that these four stories are the four branches of the Mabinogi, the four branches of the youthful tales, or the tales of the youth. But the direction of this story is towards the west. It is this, and has right at the heart of it, this sense, in the same way that the first one does, this sense of things not being honoured, things breaking down, much more dramatically this time. And just like the first branch, something has gone wrong right at the beginning. And the thing that has gone wrong is the fact that Evanescin was not included at the feast. Evanescin is the energy of destruction, of breaking, killing him. And he is sent away on a pretext. And what we're shown is this figure right at the beginning of Bendigeidvran, the great raven, looking out to sea, receiving the stranger, and the contract is inappropriately made, I guess we would say. Branwen is not consulted about it. Great contrast there with the contract of Rhiannon, where Rhiannon is the active figure and agrees to things and does things. Branwen is given, apparently without being consulted. And also Evanescin is not consulted. And Evanescin returns, bringing his energy, his destructive energies. And what happens is then Matholwch is insulted, and then we have this interesting period of dialogue where he's been given great honour and insult. So we have the opposites presented also in that way. And then we have the desire of Bendigeidvran to make it all right. And, you know, he offers him, he gives him the horses back, he also gives him gold and silver that more than compensate him. And then he gives a bit too much. He gives him the cauldron of rebirth, which we learn has magically come out of the other world. In a certain sense, out of his pride, we could say, out of his desire to be the big man. And again, it looks like everything has gone well. Everything is restored. And then, but it isn't, because actually there's this simmering resentment in Matholwch and his nobles, and then Branwen, instead of being honoured, is attacked, is insulted, is humiliated, is put into the kitchens, is kind of... And she trains a starling, those magical, extraordinary birds. If you look, I mean, mostly no starlings these days because the murmurations. If you look at a starling, it's got the most shining iridescent figures. Incredible feathers, incredibly beautiful. And then we get this image of the land of Prydain going to war with that of Ireland. And then this very fundamental process of the Irish retreating across the Liffey, destroying, burning the bridges so there's no passageway, until Bendigeidfran lays down his body so that the army and potentially the war happens within his living frame. And then what we find happening is him being offered a great house, but it's a deception, because within this house there is treachery. There are the Irishmen hiding in bags. Now in the four branches, leather bags are very kind of interesting. The key, first time we come across a leather bag is in the first branch, where Gwawl, who is about to take possession of Rhiannon, has to go into the bag, into the magical bag, to stop it absorbing all the fruit of the feasts, and then is trapped in the bag and becomes the badger in the bag. And then as a result of that, agrees to let go, to dissolve the contract with Branwen and to take no vengeance. So here we have these leather bags containing these warriors, and the person who sees through this, who represents this kind of energy of clarity and this capacity to kill, is Evanisson. And he does this very dramatic killing kind of thing, who kills 200 of them, one by one. And again, she does this very cleverly. He interrogates the people in the bag. What's in this bag? Flour! Again, he sees through, he dialogues, he discovers what is there, he destroys. And then he does this apparently unforgivable thing of killing Grevend, the son of Matholwch and Branwen. He destroys the child of the union. And then...
Child of the what?
The union between Matholwch and Branwen. And what happens then is full-on war happens, and because Bendigeidfran, in his pride, has given away the Cauldron of Rebirth, the people of the Island of the Mighty are looking like they're about to lose. And so Evanisson pretending to be a dead Irishman and entering into the sense of being a dead Irishman, is placed himself into the cauldron, stretches himself out until it falls in four pieces and his heart breaks with it, he dies with it. So the energy that is the killing energy destroys the resurrecting energy, dying with that. The energy that is the killing energy destroys the resurrecting energy, dying in that process. And what happens is this battle is cataclysmic. Seven people left, well, Brienne was the eighth in Britain, and five women, pregnant women in Ireland. So we're given the sense of a whole world being destroyed here. Now there are many points being made here, too many, so we'll come back to some of this when we meet online next, but a couple of the people that come back with the head of Bendigeidfran, who himself dies because he's been wounded in the foot, and who later we hear about, he's the early image of the wounded kings who keep the grail. But like Poich is a bit of a heedless keeper of the Grail, because he gave the Grail cauldron to Matholwch. Didn't have to. But out of his own pride, instead of just doing the ordinary reparation price, he gives this precious otherworldly thing away. And what the point that she is, one of the important points that she is making here, is that if you exclude that, and it would be like excluding the energy of Geburah from the Tree of Life. If you take away that killing energy, that disruptive energy, that enraging energy, that energy of challenge and difference and provocation, something essential is lost. And so what happens then is not a true union, not something that is going to result in true sovereignty in the generation of new life. And in order to put that right, in order for that to truly be put right, what happens is a much greater destruction. Because what happens is, in a sense, what happens is like the ground is cleared. And what happens in both, so what you see is the five pregnant women, which then give birth to the five boys, then sleep with each other's mothers, and then of course they also make it a joke about the Irish are all interbred, so there's a kind of interracial humour going on there somewhere. But also it creates the five provinces of Ireland. So what you get, so it's like you return to the beginning. It's a sort of a Adam and Eve kind of thing. So the five provinces of Ireland come to the five mothers of Ireland, the five sons of the mother. So what is being related to here is this, again, this ancient image of the mother and the son. With Branwen and Gravan, we have the mother and the son, but it's something that should not be. Because the mother is not in the place of honour. The boy is not in the place of political expediency. So what happens is actually the cauldron itself, the holy cauldron of rebirth, is shattered by the energy of the destructive energy of Evanescin. And everything has to go back to go and be reset. And it's really looking at the same kind of error that you get in Poich in a different way, in a sense of the not properly attended. In this case, Branwen is sort of shoveled to the side. Now Branwen, who tries at various points to make peace, is not able to because of the things that happen. And when she returns and reflects on what happens, her heart breaks in four pieces and they bury her in a four-sided grave. So there's something about the four pieces of the cauldron, the four-sided grave, the breaking of her heart into four places. It's like the four chambers of the heart. Where the Branwen is, of course, also the Grail, also the living. So what's happened here is that in a certain sense, it's the massive figure of Bendevivran, who should be at the service of the mother, has usurped that place. So it's Matholwch, so the kings are trying to sort it out together. The mother is not, the goddess figure is not. If you look at the story of Taliesin from a moment, one of the children of Caridwen is Movran, great raven, who is the child of the mother. Now here, this is not that. Here we're being shown the pride of kings, the masculine king, the masculine principle. And it's subtle, because at one level this figure is at one with the land. He is this giant titanic figure. But what she's also pointing at here is the way at which this sense of the autonomous masculine has to die, has to become the true. So again, we're shown here, what is it to be pen anuven? To lay your body down is to be pen anuven. To be the living bridge. And by being the living bridge, you take the poison, the wound into yourself, and you literally become the head. The oracular head that is buried in the land, that protects the land, that blesses the land. And then there is this whole period of time of the journey of that head, the maturation of that head, where the head is really immersed in the field of the birds of Rhiannon, which is all about levity, joy, beauty, all the horrors, it's like the recovering from PTSD or something, all the monstrous stuff is forgotten about until it is ready to be re-encountered when the doorway is opened into Cornwall. And there is then there is the reception, looking from Pembrokeshire towards Cornwall. And then the remembrance hits them. So then there is the return to the centre point of London, the place of the king, and the head is buried. Now the companions of the heads, two in particular are important, one being Taliesin, who is the, of course, the great bard, the great keeper of the tradition, the great teacher of the tradition. But the other is Pryderi. We hear nothing about Pryderi except he was in the Great War and survived, and was one of the seven who survived the Great War. So in a certain sense, this whole story is again about the fusion of the opposites, the process of death and resurrection. And is showing us what happens when the principle of killing and death and rage is excluded rather than included. What happens? So had Evanescence been present at the beginning, don't know what would have happened, but none of that would have happened. Something else would have happened. Some different contract, something that would have been a... It's odd, really. All the time I'm telling you this story, I keep thinking of Ukraine and Russia and the kind of sustainable peace and sort of a not making false peace, because in some ways what happens in this story is the attempt to make a false peace that doesn't hold, that then leads to much greater destruction. But this is true within us as without us, right? So that sense of the place where we will just try and settle something or patch something over, rather than follow the sense of dissatisfaction, the sense of this must not be, this shall not be, the sense of the no to its conclusion. If we, you know, what we all know is within our psyches, within relationships, within institutions, some things that are buried like that eventually emerge, and the damage is much greater, much more difficult, much more unpleasant.
But the thing is, people get so invested in a situation, this is a huge situation, stepping back from it seems impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely that.
You know, it has to pile more and more and more on.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the problem somewhere, really. But of course, fortunately, because Evanescence is invited into the war, does go into the hall. Had it not been for Evanescence, they were they would have all been killed by the Irish because they were waiting to ambush them.
I wonder if Evanescence is rather like Judas, really, in that, you know, he gets a bad press, but actually he gets a bad press because he's a pervert, because of this dreadful revenge he takes. But actually, he doesn't set it up. He is always reactive to things that have happened.
He's kind of sovereignty's defender in a way, isn't he?
I think so.
Because
there's no business in sending Branwen away from the island when she's one of the matriarchs of the island of Britain.
Yeah.
So, in a way, from the first to the second branch, in this one, we're seeing the setting up of the patriarchy.
Oh, you completely are.
Yeah.
So that's really what she's writing about. She's showing us this, in a sense, how this is it's spun out even further here. So in the first, we end, because the place where we end, the first branch, we notice, if we're careful, that Rhiannon isn't allowed to name her own son, and her son is given a difficult name. But the next jump into the sense of the Branwen, who is one of the chief matriarchs of the island, who is the holy raven of the island, has no say in whether she comes or goes. Is disposed of as a thing. And in a way, it's true. There is something about Evanescin as the protective of sovereignty, as it's kind of a, in a way, the person who stops false sovereignty. So there's appalling deed around the child, as he destroys the possibility of false sovereignty.
Isn't he a shadow too?
Yeah. Well, he is. I mean, I suppose, you know, he represents that kind of the energy, that disruptive energy that's speaking an inconvenient truth. You know, so that sense of, and in a way, he's also the energy. He's also sacrificial energy. He destroys the cauldron at the cost of his own life. So he gives himself. So his heart breaks into four pieces, and there's a strange then symmetry between him and Branwen. So there is something about him as Branwen's defender, Branwen's other half in some ways, who also dies as a result of the whole experience. And then there's a sense of then the despoiling of both islands, and then the sense of something starting to work. And then we get this funny little codicil story about Caswallon, who kills by stealth, and who has the magic cloak, so he destroys those who are supposed to hold that kind of friendship for that sovereignty place.
But Bran should never have left his own son in charge of the island.
Mm.
You know, that was a patriarchal thing, because it was, you know, Caswallon had a better claim with being related through the matriarchal line, really.
Mm.
It's really so interesting.
Now, there's a lot of layers here, more layers than we've got time for now, because we need to finish in 10 minutes. But fundamentally, right, what you're seeing in the second story is an amplification of some of the themes of the first story. And and in the middle of it, somewhere is Pryderi. Pryderi who is the child of light, somewhere in the middle of this, but not visible in any way.
Something occurred to me when you were telling the story, which is that in the first, the important stages of a man, boy into man's life. In the first, he is named,
yep.
In the second, by implication, he is armed.
Yes.
Because he goes to war. In the third branch, he will be married.
Yes.
You know, so
that's
actually
right.
It's showing, although he's not the forefront of the story.
No, we are shown the various states, and by the fourth branch, he is himself sovereign in his own court.
Yeah.
So there's a whole subtle thing going on in the background here. She is showing us, but the way in which the connection to the goddess, the way the connection to the kind of the deeper and older way of thinking is getting lost, while simultaneously showing us the process, the hidden kind of process of the development of Pryderi, who is the child of light. We'll see something much more quick and vivid about it in the fourth branch, where Chlai is the new son of light, and we'll see those stages recapitulated much more quickly.
Two questions, if possible, maybe not. The cauldron becomes Bramwen becomes the Cauldron or the Grail.
Yeah.
And then when she dies, does the head, the king's head, become the Cauldron?
Well, it sort of is. There's this whole the whole thing about the Cauldron. The Cauldron is the keeping of the Lord of Annwn. Right, so Lord of Annwn, in a sense, is both the Cauldron and the keeper of the Cauldron. Now, what we find really with Bran is that he, as the keeper of the Cauldron, in the same way he gives his sister away, gives the Cauldron away. So he doesn't act as the keeper properly. And then there's a way in which he himself then has to enact the fundamental act of being the Grail by being the bridge across opposites, and therefore, in a strange way, becomes the Cauldron. So he, in a sense, where we're left at the end of the day, when we're left in the... his head is in the deep, in the centre of the land, in the deep place of the land, is the protector of the land. Is the generative head.
Is this connected to the dying of the stag in the first?
Yes, it is. In a way, it is. It's the same mystery in different terminology. Mm. You know, the dying of the stag takes us into that Grail mystery of death and resurrection. Mm. This is also an experience of death and then the resurrection by being the living head that is in the land. That brings the opposites together. Now, if any of us had come to the Glastonbury Lake Village thousands of years ago, or a couple of thousand years ago, anyway, over the on each of the four entrances, you would have found buried in front of the entrances would have been four skulls, sacred heads. You know, I've held them. They're kind of amazing energy, actually. And they are. So this is literally a thing in the kind of in the older tradition where the ancestral head, in a sense, holds the boundary place, holds the place of protection. Is the kind of generative energy, the warrior energy that keeps out the stranger.
You know, there was seven left. Does that relate to the poem that we always hear about, "The Unknown Return"? But seven.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Is that the next story?
No.
No, it's just a link.
It jumps again, but all these things. The whole tradition here is poetic tradition that links across. Those hearing it would have known the story, known the poem, but for seven, none returned from Cae Rochren. And so here, but for seven, none return from the entrance into the other world.
And Taliesin was in both of them.
And Taliesin is in both of them. So theoretically, Taliesin is both in the story and the writer of the poem.
So that's a separate poem. The
Fidianavin. Fidianavin is a separate poem, yeah.
And is that before the Mabinogi? We don't know.
No, we don't. Truthfully, we don't know. Right.
It's linked.
But it's the same. It's the same thematic material. It's the same material that the bards would have known about. All of it we have in manuscript, as I said, from slightly later points than the Geoffrey of Monmouth stories. But they're all. But this material and Taliesin material is drawing on stuff that's much older. But we have no idea when it is because we have no manuscripts of an older age. Right. So it all comes out of the medieval time. Sorry. Got 2 minutes if anyone's got a burning question left, really.
It's like a burning bum.
It's got a burning bum, yeah, I'm surprised. It's the tail on.
It gets harder, doesn't it?
Yeah.